And so we ran, the doctor and I, across the Isle of Minos, fleeing before the approach of the gunslingers. These curious individuals were moving swiftly behind us, so swiftly, in fact, that they seemed almost to be gliding above the ground, skimming the earth, like stones sent flying across water. Past few months have been sedentary and bland to an all but intolerable degree, and so, in spite of the evident peril in which I've been placed, I felt within me the stirrings of revivification, the welcome sense that everything was once more as it ought to be. "I have to say," I said, already somewhat short of breath, "it's really rather splendid to see you again, Doctor." "You too, George. It's been too long. Far too long, don't you think?"
"Actually?"
"Yes."
"How long has it been?
I mean, more or less, give or take, since we last met."
"Almost a year," said I. "You were in disguise and sporting a peculiar accent. We had that old friend of yours to deal with, Bounder, who called himself the Master."
"Friend? Friend? He's my arch-enemy."
"Well, arch-frenemy."
"Arch what?"
"It's only language, George.
Always changing. Nothing to be frightened of."
"Anyway, so it's been a year for you."
"Ah, it's been well over a century for me."
The doctor's always had a most curious relationship to time, and I'm sure that we'd never quite met him in the correct chronological order. I remain fascinated by all things temporal, but in this instance, I thought there were questions of more immediate concern. "These men," I panted, "what was it you called them?"
"The gentlemen of the dice."
"Not, of course, that they're actually men at all."
"No, they're a breed of thought forms.
Fifth dimensional. Brought into this universe only when they're summoned.
And when they're here?
Well, you know the drill. Utterly rapacious, wholly insatiable, and definitely to be filed under a capital B for bad."
"But what do they want? I mean, what exactly?"
"Oh, they want you, George. At least, they want to feed on you, drain you dry of your fortune energy. Because it was you who summoned them, with the harmonica."
"Yes, indeedy.
But don't worry. I've got something in the TARDIS which will be able to deal with them. All we need to do is reach it before they catch us."
"So where is it?" I asked. "Your time machine?"
"Well, that's the tricky part. It's practically on the other side of the island." He looked frantically behind him, and upon seeing, I assumed, the imminent approach of our pursuers, his eyes bulged in agitated fear. "Come on, George, come on!"
Big Finish present Doctor Who Short Trips, the Jago and Lightfoot Revival. Act 2 by Jonathan Barnes. Read by Christopher Benjamin and Trevor Baxter. Meanwhile, beneath the theatre, deep underground, I, Henry Gordon Jago, in the company of a youthful and decidedly dashed new doctor, was facing down a many-limbed horror from beyond the stars.
I must say the creature does sound thoroughly grotesque.
Oh, it was. Hirsute and horrific. Bulbous bodied and quivering with homicidal intent. Oh, how I quailed. How my sturdy form was shaken with fear. We've seen many a rum sight, George, you and me, and many a hideous vision, but for sheer unvarnished terror, that monster is exceedingly hard to beat. Naturally, I stood firm against its approach, and my young friend proved just as steadfast. "Now, Henry," said he in a voice which seemed to me to speak of education at one of our knobbier public schools, "I know this doesn't look too good, and I know it's squeaky bum time." "What the deuce are you talking about? Squeaky what?" He looked up at me and grinned half dementedly. "Don't worry, I'll explain later." And with this, he brought out what seemed to be a technological wizard's wand. Indeed, at the sight of it, I was put in mind of the late and very much lamented Magnificent Morris, the master of mystery, who was once on the bill alongside Harry Hypno in the earliest days of my career. Now he waved this thing about with loose-limbed elan, while the object made a series of high-pitched squeaking sounds, rather like a mouse performing a series of acrobatic feats. He looked at this one thing, and then at me, and then at the marauding beast before us, each double-take rather broader than its predecessor. "Oh, my giddy aunt," he said. "Looks like not even the sonic screwdriver's going to get me out of this one. Come on, Henry, I suggest we make a run for it." He turned, the beast mere inches from our nose. "Come on, Geronimo!" And together the young man and I fled from the slavering jaws of that foul demon, out of the basement, up the stairs, and back through the theatre. Behind us we heard the dreadful skittering, scraping sound of the creature's mandibles upon the floor. As we emerged onto the street, I turned to my companion and, with an exasperated bravado, asked her, "I don't imagine you're going to tell me exactly what it is we're running away from." The young fellow was already dashing down the cobbled street. His words tumbled from his mouth in improbable speed. "As to what these blighters are, well, they're unfinished business. An old mistake I need to set right. And, of course, they're potentially the last thing we're ever going to see. But still, let's hope not. Keep up." "Doctor," I called out as I ran behind him, and as the nightmare followed in our wake, "Doctor, do you have a plan? Surely you must. You're the kind of fellow who always has something up his sleeve. Right now, George, the only plan I got is to try and keep us alive for long enough." "Long enough for what?" "Long enough for everything to fall into place," he said, and with another burst of speed, he took off up the alleyway and into the main thoroughfare. I felt compelled at this, partly from fear and partly out of a desire to comfort myself, to speak that talismanic exclamation, "Corks!" But in the end I chose to save my breath and preserve my puff, and so with a vigour born of desperation I ran on.
On Minos I was running too. Decidedly strange, is it not, to think of the pair of us, separated by oceans and by so many miles, both engaged practically at the same moment, and a frantic headlong dash.
And in the company of the same famously fantastic fellow too, albeit at different points in his peerlessly perplexing existence.
Indeed. Not that either of us recognised that at the time. Still, on we ran, through the island, passing the taverna and the dig on our way, abandoned now to the dusk. On and on we went, until, glimmering in the distance, down by the dark blue of the sea, I saw a familiar sight, one rendered profoundly incongruous by its placement upon the sands. The doctor's bright blue box, his travelling machine.
Ah, that transport of delight, that devilishly, dazzlingly distinguished device, the means by which the doctor traverses the chronosphere and makes his gutsily gallant peregrinations into the prepossessing provocations of the past and the freakish fascinations of the future.
That's the one. I was fagged from our run, so I don't mind admitting that I was happy indeed to see that remarkable craft hove into view. The doctor was just a little ahead of me. At his approach, to my surprise, he began to click his fingers with agitation. The doors to his TARDIS swung open, and he disappeared inside, calling out behind him, with, I thought, a touch of the costermonger in his delivery, "Be right with you, Professor! Don't worry, we've got this!" I confess, I stumbled at this flurry of incident, and as I did so, I happened to glance behind me. A mistake, I have heard, that is common amongst those who are pursued. The gazelle looking to the lion, the mouse fascinated by the curvature of the owl's wings. As for me, I saw again the blank visages of the gunslingers, their feet still hovering inches from the ground, gliding eerily closer. For a few seconds, I do believe that I was all but mesmerized by their approach. I could not move, but was bolted to the spot by some invisible force, given no choice but to watch the gentleman of the dice. And then, just at the very last moment, a point with which I believe he is well acquainted, the doctor re-emerged, holding out before him something like a futuristic rifle, connected by sundry wires and loops to a bulky knapsack. He produced the thing with a flourish. The men showed no sign of uncertainty, but merely continued their approach. "Hello, gents. Now what's all this about, then? Chasing my favourite pathologist across my favourite Greek island. Nah, just not on, is it? You've come to feed, haven't you, off George's fortune energy?" I won't wait for a reply. You had your chance. And I'm afraid this little beauty's been put together for just this sort of eventuality. Watch yourselves. 'Cause it's going to turn your own power source back on the lot of you. The gunslingers paused. I wondered why they had yet to speak until I realised the truth. They didn't have mouths. Not exactly. Not as we have them. Rather, they had mean little slits, no bigger than my thumb, which put me in mind of the insectoid. The doctor fired his peculiar rifle, and a great beam of something like sunshine seemed to emerge from it, enveloping our pursuers in a golden glow. It was like the phenomenon which we all know as ball lightning, but dragged somehow to earth. It seemed to reduce them all and lift them into the air until we were looking, the doctor and I, at a kind of globe or orb of light around the size of a billiard ball. It hung in midair, and I got the impression that it was watching him, rather balefully. "Now, there's something you don't see all that often," said the doctor. "Of course, I wasn't really sure it was going to work. But, well, you know what they say. Every day is a school day." "I have not the earthliest notion of what's been happening," I said. "And I really don't want to seem in the least bit ungrateful. But I would appreciate, at your earliest convenience, something in the way of a comprehensive explanation. George, I'd love nothing more than to tell you everything. But maybe..." He winced for a moment in sudden pain. "Maybe not today."
So while George's doctor was starting to look distinctly on the peaky side, my own rather more boyishly buoyant version was bounding briskly ahead of me in the manner of a puppy newly arrived at the homestead. I had to strain the sinews to keep pace. In the course of the chase, I pushed my body to its limits. I think the old system rather enjoyed the run around. Got the blood pumping again. Got my legs moving and my arms working like pistons. Invigorating. Just at this unexpected exercise, I felt something like my true self start to roar back to life. Oh, what a merry chase it was. What a headlong, helter-skelter dash. What fun. Terrifying as well, of course. Absolutely bone-shatteringly frightening. But bally good fun all the same. We left the new Regency and ran together towards the heart of the theatre district. Often have I traipsed through those dear old streets, stopping to converse with my public. Often have I dallied in taverns of every description, and often have I spoken, with that easy sense of camaraderie for which I'm renowned, to all who cross my path, from the very lowest of our society to its most exalted denizens, from long-faced Lily, the miserable mendicant of Magnolia Mews, to Lord Arthur Stafferton, the richest man in Sussex, and a happily high-spirited habitué of the halls. Yes, many a time and oft have I passed through the throng, able to speak to mashers and shiftmongers and litany men alike, a friend to gaiety girls and Moorgate rattlers, given freedom to pass by the howlers and the growlers, and by all the thorough-handed folk. Of course, I couldn't do any of it that day. Had to take to my heels, you understand. Had to scarper like a Dutchman on Michaelmas Eve. I barely caught sight of the thoroughfares through which we were passing, so concentrated was I simply on placing one foot before the other. Nonetheless, I am nothing if not persistently perspicacious, and there was a single instance of an oddity to which I felt obliged to draw the doctor's attention. For nobody seemed to notice us or our horrible pursuer. Not a single passerby so much as turned their head to peer perplexedly in our direction, let alone yell or scream at this impertinent intrusion of hairy horror. Doctor! I cried out, as we hurtled along the pavement, heading south towards Covent Garden. The young man called back across his shoulder, in what I felt was perhaps rather too familiar a tone. Yeah, Henry, what's on your noggin? What's on my noggin, Doctor, is this? Why isn't anyone reacting to the sight of a gigantic insect trampling through the greatest and most populous city in the world? Oh, it's a good question, yeah. I haven't got the best answer for you just at the minute. It's a bit of a weird one. I think the creature's vibrating somehow at a higher rate than any ordinary human. That's why they're not reacting. To them, it's just invisible. Oh, I see. Well, that makes sense, I suppose. But all the same, tradition dictates I ask you again about what exactly that thing actually is. It's your past, Henry, that's what it is. It's all your old mistakes made flesh, and it's come back today to haunt you. Bit tricky for a chap to come up with much of a riposte to that. So I said nothing. I just decided to run on.
Doctor, I asked, are you quite well? Forgive me, but you seem for a moment there almost to be in pain. Oh, I don't want to cause a fuss, said the young man. I mean, I might be Gallifreyan by birth, but when it comes to that sort of thing, I've always been terribly English about it. Well, almost always. He winced again, and a shadow passed across his face. Doctor, I can see that all is not well with you. Was it the run? Was it those creatures? No, no, he replied, and summed up by means of considerable concentration of will, a ghost of a smile. I'm concerned for you, I said, noticing now as I had not, in our frantic race to his ship, how pale he looked, how slick with perspiration, and how, in spite of appearing so much younger than me, he seemed weighed down by centuries. As ever, George, I appreciate that. But there's not very much that you or anyone else can do. You see, I'm going to change. Change my face, my whole being. The process, it's already started. I can't stop it now, even if I had to. But you see, before I went, I wanted to see you all again. All my old friends. And when I found you, I saw you were in trouble, and I stepped in to help. Something's wrong. Why would the gentleman of the dice be interested in you? I don't know. The harmonica's what summoned them, but nobody finds these things at random. They are meant to be found. They want to be found. But I'll discover the truth. 'Cause you see, one day I'll come back. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to come back. I believe that there was more than the doctor meant to say. But at that very moment, we both became aware of something surging behind me. The halo of golden energy which had consumed my pursuers seemed now to push forwards, its tendrils moving towards me. Watch out! For goodness sake, George, watch out! I started to run again, but it was too late. For the golden light reached me then, and it touched me. And for a long while, all that I knew was darkness. The last human sight I saw was the face of my old friend, seeming more ancient and more suffused with sadness than I'd ever seen him before.
I think I managed to block out a good deal of that weird helter-skelter chase through the city. I suspect my memory doesn't care to revisit too often some of its most bizarre elements, its most alarming moments of jeopardy and threat. I do recall that we passed a fair number of our fair city's most significant and picturesque landmarks in an order which seemed to me to be neither particularly logical or even especially possible. Still, I shall leave you, fine fellows, you members of the intelligentsia, to work up the details for yourself. Just picture the scene. The doctor before me, H.G. Jago behind, and bringing up the rear that horror, who, as in some persistent bad dream, lurked endlessly without ever catching us. At least, that is, until we were on the boat. Oh, yes, we were on a boat. Don't ask me exactly how that came about, except to say that I can recall the doctor shouting something to the effect of the creature not liking open water. We clambered on board a steamer just as it was departing. A pleasure ship which takes inebriated tourists up and down the Thames. There seemed at first to be no sign of the creature. But then by the bank, we saw it clambering into the river and moving at speed towards us, its disgusting limbs thrashing and flailing in the darkness. "Thought you said this blighter wouldn't like the drink," I said as we watched helplessly from the prow.
"Did I?" said the doctor. "Did I say that?"
"Afraid so. Still, nobody's perfect, are they?" We watched, exhausted and helpless, as the thing drew nearer. "Why don't you tell me now," I said, "exactly what that thing is?"
"Oh, okay. Well, truth is, that monster's really a gentleman of the dice."
"Gentleman of the what?"
"Nasty sort of fifth-dimensional troublemaker. That's what they really look like when someone smart, someone like, say, maybe me, has stripped away the perception filter, which usually makes them look, well, human-y."
"Well, sorry I mentioned it. Besides, what does he want with me?"
"Henry," the doctor asked with a note of disapproval, "did you ever, in all your life, call upon the gods of luck to help you?"
"Gods of what?
No, of course not. I mean, as a young man, maybe you called out for good fortune?"
"Well, I suppose there were a couple of occasions when, as a very callow young buck, I might have said, pretty much as a joke, that I wished the devil would help me win at cards."
"Oh, Henry, I knew it. I did. I just knew it."
"You mean a moment's boyish foolishness could have caused all of this?"
"Afraid so. And the gentlemen of the dice always collect. They give you good luck, but they expect it back 100-fold. Either from you or from whoever's closest to you. It's in their contract."
"I never signed any contract."
"You did. Just by making the request. Fifth dimensional, you see. Paperless office environment. Just a few words were enough."
"But that's ridiculous.
Tell me about it. The shadow proclamation keep promising to shut them down, but the dicemen seem to operate just inside galactic law. Anyway, too late now. Our friend's here."
He was right. The creature was clambering, skittering up onto deck. There was nowhere to run, and although the doctor seemed preternaturally cool, I was considering taking a dive into the Thames and striking out for shore. When we saw emerge from the mandibles of the beast a thin line of golden energy, it reached us at incredible speed. And when it touched us in an instant, before either of us could squirm away, we fell at once into what the cheaper brand of novelist would call a swoon. When I opened my eyes again, where should I find myself but, of all places, in the wings of some weird and unfamiliar theatre? Gigantic place. Cyclopean. I felt a bit like Jack after he's got to the top of the beanstalk. I groaned, managed to persuade my aching limbs to raise me to my feet. Beside me was the prone figure of the doctor, still, so far as I could tell, out for the count. I peered onto stage, and who should I see standing in the spotlight delivering some marvellously magniloquent monologue but my dear old friend, Professor George Lightfoot?
I'd been there for what seemed like hours, trapped in that impossible place, a realm of nightmares, subject to its own laws of chronology. I was made to talk and to entertain and to speak at length of my wildest experiences.
The professor was talking a good deal, doing all he could to entertain his audience. Yet it was plain to me, a lifelong practitioner of the arts of thespis, that the poor fellow was flagging. He was in the midst of relating a long anecdote concerning our encounter with that nefarious band of puppets known as the Scorchies, but he was evidently tired. I felt a firm hand on my back and a familiar voice say, "Your turn now, Henry. George has been vamping for ages."
It was the Doctor, restored and risen. What do you mean?
I mean that the audience is feeding off George's descriptions of all the coincidences and good luck you've experienced over the years. I mean, they're getting fat on it, on the fortune energy. What you've got to do now is to give them more, yeah? Much more, till they're full, till they're stuffed, till you've overloaded their little systems. And, yeah, then we can try to finish them.
I was about to ask for some clarification as to the reasoning behind this curious request, but then, without further ado, the Doctor shoved me onto stage.
I was certainly very pleased to see you. My store of narratives was starting to run dry. At first, you seemed almost pleased to find yourself beside me once again. But then I saw your face when you realised the nature of our audience.
Lummy, I thought. The audience were all spider creatures, hundreds upon hundreds of them, all packed into that vast alien amphitheatre, all of them squirming in their seats with delight, cooing and gurgling with pleasure.
The effect was thoroughly grotesque. I was put in mind of several diptychs by Hieronymus Bosch.
Confess it fair shivered me timbers as well.
But you rallied almost at once.
I tried my best, but I could see they were draining you, and me too. Getting fat on what they call our fortune energy.
Just as well they didn't realise the identity of the young man in the wings, for he has led an infinitely more improbable life than we.
Well, lives.
Quite.
Oh, look here, old chap. I'm not sure I ever apologised to you properly for causing the whole thing in the first place. I mean, if I hadn't called on the devil when I was a young fella playing cards, thereby unwittingly establishing an unconscious contract with the so-called gentleman of the dice, we'd never have found ourselves in that spookily shuddersome scenario.
Henry, my dear fellow, you've really no need to say sorry at all. For who amongst us has not done something foolish when we were young? Indeed, is not recklessness the very prerogative of youth?
You mean even you acted unwisely when you were well and 20?
Oh, Henry, there are several stories I could tell you. At least three.
Really?
You don't know everything about me, even now.
Intriguing and enticing, Professor. But we owe it to the audience to finish our present tale for now, I think.
Indubitably so.
Once I got my bearings, I set to work spinning yarns and telling tall tales, relating some of our adventures. But before long, starting to embroider them, to elaborate and exaggerate. At first, the creatures chuckled and writhed in delight, but as I went on, I began to sense them becoming almost uncomfortable with my torrent of story, at the extremities of its chances and wild coincidences. The atmosphere in that mighty auditorium began to shift and change, to become fuller somehow, as though a great hot air balloon were being inflated beyond its natural limitations.
I was standing at the rear of the stage and trying to catch my breath while all this was happening. I was content for Henry to perform, but as his tales multiplied, I noticed that he began to grow pale and more weak, as the gentleman of the dice dined upon his fortune energy. I was wondering how I could intervene when I saw another figure stride onto the stage, a rangy man with a face that seemed simultaneously ancient and youthful, and who, for some reason, was wearing a fez. He began to juggle rather inexpertly, in order, I assumed, to assist Henry and to distract the monstrous crowd from his growing weakness.
I was grateful for it. I don't mind admitting that, for all the fellow was still quite the worst juggler I'd ever seen.
In the midst of his act, the man, whom I soon came to guess was another version of the Doctor, reached into his pocket, removed a metallic object, and threw it over to me. I caught it and saw that it was a very old and rusted harmonica. At first, I thought it a cousin to that which I had discovered upon the beach at Minos, but then I realised that it was the self-same mouth organ, somehow, mysteriously, even more decayed. "Play it, George," said the Doctor smilingly, and added, "What some of them can also imprison them, too." I was not entirely certain of the possibility of doing as he asked, that weird melody seeming to me then to be half forgotten. Nonetheless, I knew I had to do my best, as I saw Henry, for all that he surged on, continue to grow weaker.
It was a most odd experience. A test of stamina, I suppose. My will, our will, George, against these legions of monsters. And you did it, didn't you? Somehow, you were able to place the harmonica to your lips and play again what you'd played on Minos.
I did, though I can claim no skill in the matter. It was more a question of allowing possession, of letting that strange tune emerge again.
And, combined with the willful overstoking of my memories, it had the effect that the doctor had promised. Oh, the spider creatures! These so-called gentlemen of the dice fought back! They squealed and they wailed, and many made for the stage. But by the time they truly understood what was happening, it was already too late. That strange golden light returned and enveloped them all, like cold fire, I thought, like some impossible inferno. We watched as it spread over that horrid assembly. And when it touched us, George and I found ourselves instantaneously back where we belong, back in the new Regency, as if the whole thing had been but a bizarre hallucination.
A strange experience, to be sure. Oddly dreamlike.
And there's so much we still don't understand about it. The true way in which the gentlemen of the dice operate. Whether they were transformed or destroyed by that golden light. How the doctor had got hold of that old harmonica when you'd thrown it with such vigour deep into the ocean.
Now that, I think I can help you with.
Excuse me? What's the meaning of this commotion?
It's Ellie, Professor. She must have sneaked into your lecture. Shocking behaviour. I think she's in some sort of disguise.
Good Lord, what a night.
Ellie, my dear, won't you join us up by the lectern? It's the more the merrier up here.
I'm not sure that this is the kind of speech which the club had in mind when we founded it.
No doubt it's not. Well, I expect they didn't imagine they could have so much entertainment of an evening either.
Oh, hello, gents. Interesting story, I suppose. Notice I only had the smallest role, as usual.
Oh, now, Ellie, my dear, we've spoken about this.
No need, Mr. J. By this point, I'm well used to it. But listen, I've got a message for you two.
Oh? A message from whom?
From a good-looking young fellow with a bow tie. Think you know who I mean. He asked me to tell you two things. Firstly, that he fished out the harmonica from the sea himself when he took a couple of friends on holiday to Greece in the year 1982.
Good grief.
Remarkable.
And secondly, that if you've a mind to join him, he'll stand you both a glass of ginger beer at the Red Tavern at 9 o'clock tonight.
9 o'clock? But Ellie, that's now.
Oh, really, sir? So it is, sir.
Well, then, seems to me that our course is clear.
I am happy to concur. A gentleman of the CCSM, it is my privilege to call this convocation to a close. I trust that this paper has been surprising, informative and illuminating. If you have any questions, I should be more than happy to take them in person or to correspond with any one of you. Oh, I see. It's like that, is it?
Looks like your audience is abandoning you, Professor. I shouldn't take it personally. It was always a tough old crowd. Reminds me of my days at the Glasgow Empire.
Seems like you're stuck with us instead.
Eddie, my dear, there's no stuck in the matter. It would be my privilege to accompany you both to our usual haunt.
And ours to have you by our side as we encounter once again that mercurial, many-faced magus whom we are pleased to call the Doctor. A fine evening awaits us all. Happy days ahead. Wouldn't you agree, George? George? Professor?
I'm sorry. Yes, of course. It's just that for a moment I thought I heard something from very far away. An old tune. Some half-remembered melody. I'm sure it's nothing. Whoa, so then, Henry, Miss Hickson, shall we?